sense of it, lots of luck. If you could do that, you could probably build something better, faster, cheaper, with a lot less work on your effort. But let me add an aside. What I'm talking about right now with Flex Radio is the 6000 series, which came out approximately 8 years ago. Before the 6000, they had other models. Their original model was actually a kit based on articles that the president of Flex Radio wrote for QST. You know, he built it as a kit. People contacted him. He started to sell the kit. Then he built more sophisticated. The most sophisticated model I'm aware of before the 6000 was the 3000. The 6000 uses Ethernet connections to the computer. The 3000 uses FireWire, which was good in its time, but lots of luck really finding too many FireWire interfaces anymore. But there's still a lot of people using the 3000, and they love it. The 3000's interface to the computer was actually open source, which is probably why the new one wasn't open source. And there are people who have significantly improved the usability of the 3000 in some ways better than my 6000 based upon that. They have rewritten the software to include rather sophisticated diversity reception. They can listen on two different antennas. They can do phase calculations and try and limit the noise based upon different parameters from the two antennas. So there are even Flex radios that are more open to third parties, and they've done great things with it. I'm just saying that with the 6000, I think they learned from what they thought was a mistake, and they locked everything down.
Boy, I have a Kenwood 440 that's 30 years old and still going strong. Would you think SDR radios have the same kind of staying power in terms of usability, or like would your Flex radio that's 8 years old in another 2 years be a boat anchor, or you think it has some staying power?
Well, like most things, you're somewhat dependent upon the company that manufactures them. Gone are the good old days where you can pop the top of a boat anchor and there are these enormous capacitors and all kinds of discrete components that it's very likely you can get replacements for. Nowadays, even the analog radios, you open them up and it looks like a bunch of chiclets pasted to a printed circuit board. And if the manufacturers who manufacture those integrated discrete components stop manufacturing them and there's no stockpile, then you're in bad luck. So ultimately it depends upon the components, the manufacturer, what have you. Right now, if you went to Flex Radio and looked for the best radio today as opposed to the best radio 8 years ago, you would end up with my 6700. So I'm kind of thankful for that. It gets a little annoying when you're obsoleted somewhat. So it stays non-obsoleted for 8 years. Now, in 2 years, will they bring out the 7-6701 or something? What would it do? I don't know. It's always possible. Ultimately, I think your radio will have a longer lifespan than most modern software-defined radios as a class. But I think the Japanese companies, unless some kind of shakeup happens, they'll have enough supplies to kind of maintain them for a time. But ultimately, they're not going to store chips, audio chips or what have you chips, for 40 years. No company does that. I know someone who tried to get just instructions, a service manual for, I think, a 12-year-old radio, and the company said they don't even keep it in print anymore. So it's going to be more difficult for third parties to fix radios that are built today than were built 30, 40, 50 years ago. suddenly at?
The component and the spacing are getting smaller and smaller. For decades, the standard has been 10th of an inch pinouts on the IC form. Then they went down to a 20th of an inch, 50,000. And that is about the limit you can possibly do it yourself with there. Nowadays, they're down to 25,000, 20,000, even less. And you need millions of dollars worth of equipment to work on those boards. So they're basically, you know, the boards are definitely, you know, throwaway components by themselves.
Yeah, I agree with you, Ed. And unfortunately, again, we discussed it in the past, the disposable economics of commercial electronics are bleeding into amateur radio. I told the story before that I had a flat screen television under warranty that failed, and the guy just popped off the back, pulled out a circuit board that had to be about a square foot and a half in surface area, popped in a replacement, screwed the back on, turned it on to make sure it worked, and he was gone. And they're not going to fix that board. It's just going to throw it into the hole along with all the other garbage. So this is our brave new world. And, you know, there are good aspects to it, and there are terrible aspects to it.
Dollar for dollar, is there any reason to buy an analog radio today going forward?
If it does what you want and you like how it works, I see no reason why simply to buy a software-defined radio, because it's a software-defined radio. Ultimately, it doesn't do what you need it to do. I have crazy requirements. I, for some strange reason, like the idea that I could receive 9 transmissions across the and simultaneously record, process, or do whatever the hell I want with them. I do that with any kind of realistic analog radio that wasn't built for the Pentagon. You will with software-defined radio. So ultimately, it's not what it is, but what it does, and does it do what you need it to do for the price that you need to pay for.
Well, as ham radio operators, we all need it to do the same thing, really. Basically, don't we? We want the best sensitivity, the best selectivity, the best audio. And so we all want the same thing. It just doesn't seem like investing in an analog radio today, especially a high-end analog radio today, is investing in the future, if you know what I mean. If software-defined radios, depending on the company, but I think we could put our faith in Yaesu and Kenwood and ICOM going forward, I think you have a better chance to have a continually state-of-the-art radio for the software-defined radio than an analog-defined radio. But I don't know. I like the knobs also, by the way, all the knobs, rather than just the box and a computer.
This is a non-issue.
Yes, I agree with you, because the all the companies are going to end up with SDRs on chips. As the technology progresses, they're going to be able to shrink the dies and compress a lot of the SDR functions into a smaller and smaller group of chips. And everything is going to go from a kind of they're going to go from legacy. I don't know if it's that easy to find a model radio designed in the last 7 or 8 years that's truly fully analog. Some of them are mixed. They go up to an IF stream and then they turn into SDRs, and a lot of them just start off after the front end SDR. So the future is that you're going to probably find it impossible to get new analog designed radios out there. It just is not going to be cost effective. But, you know, still, a lot of people buy older radios, and they're very happy with them. So, you know, and also it depends upon the individual. You kind of mentioned the basics of good, of the way that a radio is quote good. Some people don't like fan adapters. I love fan adapters. I talked to an old-timer that said the only way that you find weak signals is with your ears and twirling the dial. You don't look at a pan adapter. And, okay, fine. That's the way he wants to play it. Let him play it like that. But, you know, it depends. You like knobs? I kind of like knobs, but I actually have things that add on to my computer that add knobs and dials and all kinds of displays, and I still just use my computer these days. So it's what you get used to, you know. I got used to a trackball with a computer. A lot of people who never use a trackball don't know how to use them, although they're rather easy, and only can use a mouse or, you know, have some other method. So it's what you learn to live with, what you're happy with using.
You know, the SG-891 and the IC-7300 have knobs and dials.
Yes, you will find that most radios that are SDRs have knobs and dials, and there is no way from the outside to figure out whether they're analog or they're software-defined radio. And I think there's a good marketing reason for that, because especially the Japanese companies tend to be conservative. They don't want to scare people. They don't want to force new technology. So, you know, my 6700 has basically six buttons, a total of six buttons. There's a right, left, up, down, okay, and there's a power button. Otherwise, that's it. And I don't mind. I don't care. But a lot of people would. So when ICOM was designing theirs, when Yaesu was designing theirs, all these guys, they have knobs and dials, and they look just like the old analog ones.
Sick camp radio operators, and Ed, I think, would agree with this. A lot of camp radio operators get into aviation, and I think it's that same entry with all the knobs and the dials and the switches that attract ham radio operators into aviation, and vice versa, I guess. So I'm sure they know, their marketing people know, they've done enough marketing tests to know that they, for the most part, cannot do all the way away with knobs and dials. Anyway, Roy, so you answered my questions, and I appreciate it. Maybe next week we could get into the I and the Q. I'm still a little hazy about that, but I know they're pretty deep rabbit holes. So, 70, thanks, Roy. Back to you.
Okay, very good, Rich. Thanks for participating. I just want to close things on this particular subject with this. Not that I'm young at heart or anything. I think that you will, if this hobby progresses more towards the younger people, you're going to find a demographic shift between people loving knobs and people loving control surfaces. Because, you know, younger people think in terms of control surfaces. Their phones are control surfaces. Their computers are control surfaces. You know, guys like you and me, most of the control of devices when we were growing up were knobs and dials. Television sets, radio sets, all kinds of things. There were no touch screens. So I think, although we're looking at it through the lens of our the times that we grew up, I think younger people will take to control surfaces a lot quicker and fully without it having to be hidden behind knobs and dials. But that's just my surmise.
Know why that's happened, Roy?
It happened that way because that was the only way you could control electronic devices.
No, what I'm saying is they've gotten to the point with the, you know, flat screen touch panels that they are cheaper than having all the knobs and the dials.
Well, yeah, I agree with you, but even if that wasn't the case, I think that the concept of the personal computer has kind of produced that general sensibility, especially among younger people, that they don't mind using a display device as a control surface. Whereas I think if you went back in time to 1960 and gave someone an iPhone, they would think that you were some evil black magic type of a wizard. But aside from that, I think that they would be confounded by it, because the metaphor just was not known. It was a complete unknown. It's my problem that I have all the time when people write articles of what's going to happen technologically in 50 years. We don't have a basis for that. We don't know how people are going to respond to technology that we don't even know exists yet. So I always find that problematic. But I think it's not purely a cost factor. I think it's just ubiquitous across technology because of the success of personal computers.
WS2N.
Cool.
I remember, I'm sure you do too, you have black and white TV, and your parents say, don't touch that screen. You know, you're going to put a mark on it. Don't go near it. You know, not only don't sit on top of it because you're going to blow your eyes out, but, you know, don't touch the screen. That's your word.
My parents were very nice about that. Either they didn't know or care, or they had a lot of hope that I would not do silly things. I was the guy, I think it was the fifth grade, I was the guy who fixed the television set. So I took out the tubes and took them to the corner and tested them and replaced them. So I was the maintenance guy. So I was always in there. So I was touching every bit of those places. But then, again, I also used to, I was interested in chemistry, so I used to make explosives. And for some odd reason, my parents didn't, so either they weren't fully aware or didn't quite understand, and got away with that too. So I did not have the safety harness that befits most children these days.
There's a kernel of truth to what Paul said.
Would you like to expand that?
Absolutely, I would like to. In the early days of color television, they found that the color TV had a significantly higher anode voltage on the CRT, and they were actually emitting X-rays and the like for, you know, a couple of feet in front of the screen. So they put out warnings, do not have your kids sit right face up against the TV. But in a couple of years, they sorted that out, so it was a fairly short-lived problem.
Yeah, I remember that, but the problem was that most people who warned children, I don't think they were aware of that reason. They thought it was bad for your eyes. They also thought that looking at a bright object in a darkened room was bad for your eyes. There was a lot of, don't do that, you'll go blind. I think that was kind of a slogan for raising children in the 50s and the 60s.
K2SD.
I didn't get that entirely, but it might have been Chris.
Yes, it is. Thanks, Roy. K2SDP. I find it fascinating that the older 77s had some 7,000 buttons and knobs in the flight deck, and the new ones have something like 40 or 50 because it's all touch screens and computers. However, one of the things that still does have a button and a knob is, you guessed it, the radio.
Okay, I mean, you know, a lot of us are stuck in our ways. So there's no particular reason why you can't put a button on things. But, you know, you can kind of see the future even through Star Trek The Next Generation. If you remember, Star Trek, the original show, had a bunch of these cubes Yeah, they were plastic Lucite that were lit, apparently. And so they were pushing on all kinds of buttons. And then you go to the next generation, and it's all control surfaces. I mean, it's all gibberish and nonsense, but it's control surfaces. So, I mean, ultimately, you know, it would be curious to kind of take a quick look at a piece of equipment from 100 years in the future, how many knobs they're going to be, and how much of it is just going to be some kind of interesting tactile surface device.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul. By the way, I think they call that haptic when they put in a little bit of a feedback piezoelectric device or something that gives you a little bit of a kickback when you control using surface virtual buttons. But yes, Paul?
I kind of miss what Chris was talking about with the cockpits. I don't know if he was talking about planes or spacecraft or whatever. You take the Apollo system with thousands of dials and buttons, toggle switches, you know, compared to the touch screens that are in the Dragon spacecraft and now what Boeing is making as well on their Starliner. You know, you take an incident that was going on with Apollo 12, there was all kinds of vibrations that were occurring because they had gotten hit with lightning. And Alan Bean needed to, he's the one that remembered the switching complex set up to fix the problem of this vibration that he was having. And he remembered a switch to throw. But as it was vibrating, he was able to reach over it and push that proper toggle button. Could you imagine somebody in a Dragon spacecraft with that kind of vibration trying to touch the touch screen? You know, I mean, you know, if you're riding in a car and somebody hits a bump, you can't even text somebody. You know, you wind up with making a mistake. So I don't know. Sometimes the older systems I think would be better. Although it's not practical nowadays, but for certain things like that, I think that would be very, very good. Not these touch screens. Back to you, Warren.
Yes, Ed.
With smaller planes now, the so-called glass cockpit is mostly displayed. I do not recall any actual touchscreens, and I think that Paul's hit on it, is that we're always fat-fingering stuff on a phone. You really don't want to do that on an autopilot.
Okay, I mean, I'm sure specific mechanical switches will stay around for a long, long time unless or until someone comes out with even a newer type of weird technology that I can't even get at. But for the most part, density and the ability to shift screens, you can have a finer control of more variables with shell surfaces because you can kind of shift what they're controlling. So in the long run, I think control surfaces are here to stay. They might be improved, and there might be aspects that we can't imagine. But there's probably still a place for mechanical switches. But mechanical switches have problems as well. So, yeah, always it's a compromise between different technologies.
K2 FTP.
Yes, Chris.
Yeah, Paul made a really good point about hitting the touch screens when you're getting bounced around. Or I should say, if you're getting bounced around. I experienced that fairly often at an offshore fishing boat. And when you're 100 miles offshore, 6 or 8 foot seas bouncing around, I had a huge GPS display that I operated pretty much everything with. And I can attest to it being very difficult to click on little buttons or icons on the display rather than reaching down and hitting a button or turning a knob. So I've often wondered that. I wonder if in software they enlarge the buttons for the important buttons if there is turbulence or something. I wonder if they've thought of that. Probably have. K2SDP.
Well, I see no reason why they can't. It's not like the very, very primitive, highly pixel touch screens of the past. I had things like that that you could just barely play tic-tac-toe with because they had no resolution. Nowadays, all these touch screens have very high resolution, so you could define a button with any dimension and be able to recognize when the finger is pressed anywhere in that coordinate.
Yeah, I'd definitely be interested to find if they have some clear adjustment, if they're getting bounced around, if the important buttons they think they might get enlarged. In other words, it's a one inch square normally, and when they're bouncing around, it becomes 3 inch square, so they can actually hit it. I would like to research that and try to find out. Interesting.
I haven't heard anything about that, so I'm not an expert, but it's not a new thing.
WS, do I have a comment about the buttons on the spacecraft?
Yeah, sure, Paul. By the way, you guys out there, if you want to, you could try patenting it. You never know. All it takes is an accelerometer, is an actuator, and it can kind of do it built into the software. But, Paul, you wanted to say something.
Yeah, on Dragon and on Starliner, they do have buttons and able to control it without the touch screen. But not everything is going to be able to be done that way. Otherwise, they'd have an infinite amount of buttons and switches again. And, for instance, the switch that Alan Bean pushed, nowadays, you would have all your common problem could be solved with, the certain dials and switches that they do have on the spacecraft. But, the way it is, it's like our radios, if you were to look for that particular switch that was not a common one that Alan Bean pushed, you'd probably have to go into the menu, and rotate the dial and push the dial and hit enter, and it might be somewhere buried in the menu, by that time, they'd call the mission off. Next thing you'd have it aboard. I could see problems. I hope they all consider this when they put all this stuff together. I'm sure they deal with, you're rolling the dice. Back to you, Roy.
Well, ultimately, we're all rolling the dice here. What can you do? I mean, they try and think of things as best they can. Engineers think a little bit different than other people. So if you have a Android phone versus an iPhone, you sort of get the idea of what happens when there are more engineers and less PR and marketing people making decisions about design. So I hope they design things well. I'm sure they try to, and things will get better. But there's always cases where old stuff sometimes is better than new stuff. But I think the problem is that most of the time, it's a lot easier and a lot cheaper and a lot faster to use the new stuff, and the new stuff usually works well too. So.
WHCTL Mobile, if I can talk.
Certainly, Andy.
All right, here I am in the car, first time. Yeah, by the way, I just let you guys know, I'm almost at my stop here. That extra ka-chunk that I'm hearing, I think the loading comparator is in the line. I think that's what Steve did, so it's making it sound a little bit, the audio hollow sounding. I believe that's where it's coming from.
Talk
Okay.
Is this a plan to be a long-term thing, or is this a short-term thing?
Well, the voting will be long-term, but I think it has to be, you know, fine-tuned, adjusted, and everything else. Because I do hear the ka-chunk, and the audio does sound different. Because I know he was up there, and I know that he connected the comparator. So I would think that's what's going on.
Okay. Like I said before, we're all understandable, and we'll just deal with the slightly different audio and see how things develop.
Yes. Okay. All right. I was just listening in. By the way, as far as developing, so I've now developed a loss of taste and smell. It's there, but it's much less noticeable. Or it's faded, whatever word I can think of. Not as strong as it used to be. The strength of it is not as good.
Do you smell voice burning when there is no fire?
I think I can do that. All right, I'll be right back. Go ahead, Roy.
I have a reason to say that, Roy.
I assume you're alluding sometimes when people are having a stroke, they have artificial sensations, and one of them is wood burning.
No, I've known a lot of people who had COVID-19 say they've lost their sense of taste, their sense of smell, but they do smell wood burning for absolutely no reason whatsoever. It's anecdotal, but I hear it time after time after time.
Okay, that's curious. I wonder what's going on with that. I mean, the understanding of the loss of smell is that the virus apparently attacks the area where the sense of smell through the nerve endings travel and causes swelling and cuts off the signals to the brain. But I wonder what is the aspect of the smell of smoke that seems to penetrate that problem. Or maybe it's not directly smelled, but some kind of other sensory that's inferred in some strange way. I'm sure you wouldn't.
I smell wood burning all the time when I'm with the Boy Scouts camping.
Yes, well, those campfires might be causing some of it.
I'm back for another few minutes.
Okay, glad to have you back, if only for a few minutes.
Yeah, hello, Ted. You know, it's funny, I was feeling better yesterday, and today I felt lethargic and sleepy, and my energy level is down again. Of course, my voice is not back, but I don't feel sick, so I'm still reacting. This probably will go on for a while.
Are you talking about long COVID, Andy?
I don't know if it's long or short. I just hope it goes away.
This isn't, by the way, long COVID. Long COVID is having problems long after you're infectious and such. What Andy is discussing is that it's not a smooth graph function of infection to being normal again. There are bumps in the road. And especially if you kind of overextend yourself, if you feel a little bit better, so you decide that you can do more things, and then you do too many more things, and then you're back on your back. So that's just the variability of any kind of infectious state. That you have to rest it, and you can't simply assume that it's gone away because you feel a little bit better, you know, 3 hours later or a day later.
I agree with that. That's true. Well, I rested, of course. Alright, I'm just about at the store.
Okay, Andy, be well. You gotta learn how to stockpile. You know, every so often I'll hear these people on the radio and, you know, they got these big bags of beans and, you know, they're ready for World War 3, 4, and 5.
I didn't even say I was distracted. My phone rang.
I said that you might consider stockpiling to a small degree, because if you listen on a lot of these frequencies, you'll bump into people who are bottling water and keeping sacks of beans and rice, and they're preparing just in case World War III, IV, and V happen consecutively. So, stockpile.
I got a lot of stuff. I did a few days ago. But, I ran out of water. The most essential thing. I don't drink any tap water. I've been drinking a lot of water, that's the thing, so I've been using it up a lot.
All right.
Yes, Ed?
A lot of those people are going to ham licenses now because they want to have off non-infrastructure communications. And some of the crazier ones are stockpiling firearms to protect their beans from hordes of marauding scavengers.
Yes, I know that very well. I have been promoting, because it's a very curious thing if you look at licenses for amateur radio. If you look at every single other country around the world, the number of licensed amateurs is slowly, unfortunately, going down, except in the United States, which is about at the peak of historically, there have never been as many licensed amateur radios as there are today. It's over 750,000, and something like 500,000 or 600,000 of them are technicians licensed. So it is my theory that most of these people are just saving up frequencies for the end times, and the same way that they're storing up beans and rice and water and teaching each other how to reshell cartridges and use bullets repeatedly, all that's going on. So, yeah, we've had more than a few people wander by the repeater who talks about how they have a Facebook page where they teach other people to do all that, especially, you know, reshelling cartridges, or however it's defined.
Roy, I know a tremendous amount about that, with the pluses and minuses, and I'm not sure it's such a great idea, and it's a way to blow your head off.
Well, yes. Yeah, I agree with you. I guess if you know what you're doing, it's one thing. If you don't know what you're doing, it's a totally different thing. But these guys don't basically sound like they know what they're doing anyway. So yeah. It's not like your warning or our warning is going to make any difference for these people. They're waiting for the sky to fall.
No, but seriously, Roy, I know quite a bit about cartridge reloading. I have done it. And you have to be anal about it. You have to be very precise. There's no room for being sloppy.
Hey, is it good to be
on? Yes, sir.
Almost nothing to do with ham radio, except some preppers out there. I'd rather talk about channelization and frequencies.
What can I tell you, Jeff? We wander to and fro, but hopefully we go back on the road.
I'd like to see you there, Roy. Good to hear you. You're doing a great job, as always.
Thank you, Jeff. Anyway, yeah, explosives are very dangerous. As a person who played far too much with them as a child and got away with it, you got to respect the chemistry. You don't respect chemistry, chemistry blows your backside off, which is not fun. Never happens to me, thankfully. So, anyway, I caution everyone out there, treat explosives with a great deal of respect, and you know, they won't blow up in your face. Anyway, This is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the TechNet, the Limar Technical Net. I thought I would mention a couple little technical things that I read about in this last week, and we could either discuss it or not, depending upon the interest of people listening. One is we've talked in the past about digital signals, DSTAR, Fusion, EMR. We've talked about hotspots. Most of them are based on Raspberry Pi and RF hats and some PiStar software. A company that makes a very nicely designed product, I think out of Estonia, makes the OpenSpot hotspot. I own one OpenSpot 3, which used to be their latest and greatest model. If you'll remember earlier tonight, I mentioned how annoyed I tend to get when my latest and greatest toy is obsoleted. So OpenSpot has announced the new model, the OpenSpot 4s. There are two varieties of them. They say that the 4 design uses more powerful CPUs. They boot up faster. They operate faster. They require a little bit less energy, and the battery is more efficient. In addition, they split up the 4 into two ports. One has two AMBI chips. Those are the voice encoder decoders. The high-end one has two of those chips so that you can use any radio for any hotspot gateway. In other words, if you have a regular PiStar and you have a DSTAR radio to get into the PiStar, you can only go from a DSTAR into DSTAR gateway. So you can't go into DMR gateways, you can't go into Fusion gateways. With the OpenSpot 3, they started building in bidirectional AMBI chips so that you could use a DSTAR and use it to get into a DMR, or a DMR to go into a DSTAR. So they split up the OpenSpot 4s into two different models. One is going to have the same...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Okay, thanks Chris, by the way, in the chat room, he told me I timed out. Anyway, like I said, so the OpenSpot 4 was split into something very much like the OpenSpot 3, which allows any digital radio to work on any gateway, and there's a cheaper version that doesn't have that feature. So that's the new OpenSpot 4, if anyone wants to talk about it. Okay, I guess no one's interested in hotspots tonight. Let me try you on another one. I don't know if you know in previous history, I was very fascinated by, again, we'll go back a little bit to digital radios. Digital radios is that they're all unfortunately proprietary. So if you have a Fusion repeater and you want to talk on it, well, you need a Yaesu Fusion radio. Otherwise, nothing else is going to work. If you have a DSTAR, well, then there's one version of, I think, Kenwood that operates DSTAR, but otherwise it's ICOM, and only ICOM. What's DMR? The major Japanese companies haven't really fixated on DMR. So you get a DMR radio, but can't use a DMR radio for Fusion, can't use a Fusion radio for DSTAR, it's a mess. A couple years ago, a couple of companies came out and said that they were going to build these lovely one radio does it all. In other words, you plug it in, you turn it on, and you can go to a DSTAR repeater and talk DSTAR, you can go to a DMR repeater and talk DMR, you can go to a Fusion repeater and talk Fusion. So there are two companies. Let me drop for a sec. Okay, don't want to time out this time. Anyway, there were two companies. One was Connect Systems. They basically rebrand Chinese radios. And there was another company that was run by for major cellular companies as engineers. And on the weekend, they made little gizmos for digital radios. And so both of those people announced. And they both fell on their faces. The cellular phone engineers went back to their day jobs. And Connect Systems just said, we tried, but we couldn't get the Chinese manufacturers to do it. Nevertheless, about a week ago, I get an email that Kinect Systems is coming out with a brand new radio, which they have designated the CS800D Pro, which in the quick hand copy, it will be capable of DMR, D-Star, Fusion, and I think P25. The problem is reading the little print. The little print is that when you buy it for 400 and change, it only does DMR. Now, how do you do D-Star? How do you do Fusion? Well, unfortunately, you do it through an output pin going to a computer, which they say can be as simple as a Raspberry Pi or as complex as a personal computer, and software. Well, what software? Well, no software that's out there right now, but maybe soon or later, someone will write the software that lets you do that. Let me drop for a second. So, right now, it seems somewhat like vaporware. Although they are selling the radios, and the other feature of the radio is it has apparently more memory. But supposedly, it has an output pin, and if plugged into a computer, and if someone writes all the software, then if all that happens, theoretically, and it works, you could get all the other things other than DMR. So right now, it's a DMR radio with a half promise of turning into an all-in-one. Personally, I think anyone interested should wait until people come out with the software and tell you how good, bad, or different it is. I don't think there's any benefit for being the first guy in the block to hand over your money for this type of a deal. Plus the fact that a lot of people have gotten very comfy with hotspots that, although they don't work on repeaters, work on internet access points, and are capable of accomplishing pretty much everything without the hassle. Anyway, anyone with any comments upon that?
AC2PL query. KD2UQK. KD2WOT.
Okay, Jeff first.
Hey, Roy. A fascinating topic. The only question I have really is some of the older DMR radios and Fusion radios, there are some kind of young computer hotshots that have asked me for those older rigs, and of course I've given them to them because they're experimenters, and they said there's a way to reflash the chips such that you can make them essentially DMR scanners or Fusion scanners. It's like, I don't know, some of these machines, you have to program them very heavily in order to even open up a particular repeater, but the way this, and I have some of the details, I just can't recall them right now. The way this software works is that it turns them into scanners, where instead of actually having to key up and open a particular repeater, you can actually just scan through and look for repeaters the way you would with an analog radio. I don't know if you've heard of that particular application. Go ahead.
No, I haven't. Well, I mean, DMR kind of allows that. They had a great term. It's not used ubiquitously. It's called promiscuous mode. It basically doesn't require that you set a given talk group to a frequency, because at the beginning with DMR, you would have to, it has its own squelch intelligence that if you didn't set the proper talk group that's talking on the repeater, it would squelch the output. But in promiscuous mode, anything that comes out of the repeater doesn't get squelched, so you hear it. So probably not that difficult to have it jump from frequency to frequency. The problem with all these damn digital modes are twofold. One is that they use slightly different ways to modulate the digital stream. And the digital stream is a little different. But in addition, the voice encoder decoder were different. D-Star uses an older AMBI chip than DMR and Fusion. So you would have to either simulate one vocoder or the other to get the other radios capable of transcoding the vocoder mechanism.
AC2PL, Roger. Yeah, the machines that I've seen have had a maximum of the ability to decode two at once, but let's hope that that the open source people continue to do their good work. Anyway, back to repeat, back to net. Thanks, Roy, as usual, AC2PO.
You're welcome. I mean, open source is capable of so much amazing stuff. I mean, the guys out there are so clever, and they are so generous with their time and effort. And there are so many things that are free. I use BlueDB, which is a software that will use a hardware AMBI chip to decode all these gateway streams. Without any radio at all, I have it running on my computer, and I can set it for any of the different protocols, DMR, D-Star, Fusion, what have you. So I'm amazed and astounded. I wish I could buy them either a cup of coffee or a can of beer. Anyway, next on the list I wanted to mention, talk about this, was UQK.
Yes, thanks, Roy. This is Rob, KD2UQK over here in Deer Park. I'm just confused as to the application of this device. As you know, why would you buy this thing when you can go out and get a clear node that already has digital bridge MMDVM digital bridging built into it? So you can use any analog radio and go to any one of the digital modes, or just use PiStar that already has the modes natively and has a lot of cross-moding that you could cross-mode, say DMR to YSF and DMR to YSF to P25, and there's a whole bunch of unofficial codecs out there too that you could do all this translation. I'm just a little confused as to the point of the device and why you would buy it over one of the already established methods of adapting your radio to these digital modes.
Well, I think of it historically. It's kind of, a lot of times, unfortunately, there are solutions to problems that don't exist. I tend to look upon this as a solution to a problem that existed 5 years ago, which is a little bit better than one that never existed, because I sort of agree with you. I would assume, and it's pure assumption, that these guys are kind of focusing on these guys with clipboards that say, this isn't ham radio, that isn't ham radio, the other thing isn't ham radio. Anytime you mention anything about a gateway, any hotspots, any ISP, any internet, and they pull up the clipboard and tell you that it's not ham radio. So my guess is that this is more focused for guys who specifically want to be able to go from a radio to a repeater.
Okay, I understand. It's a little bit strange. It's a little bit strange of a concept because you're using a device that you could go natively into and get to the same destination as going through the repeater to go through the repeater. That's a little strange. But all right, thanks, Roy.
Yeah, I would agree. For you and me, it's a little strange. But having talked with guys I mentioned earlier, where he didn't like SDRs at all, and PAN adapters especially, and he felt that the only proper way to find a weak signal in the grass was to simply sit there with a headphone and a knob and twirl the VFO until you heard it with your ears and such. So, you know, we're all different. Some people, again, there are guys out there with clipboards who will tell you at a moment's notice that whatever it is that you're doing is somehow not amateur radio. So, you know, I mean, again, we're dealing with human beings, and you got to love them. They're kind of strange at times.
Yep, I totally understand. All right, thanks, Roy.
Okay, very good. Chris, KD2WOT, you wanted to say something as well.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with all of those recent comments. I didn't kind of see the sense to it either, you know, since you're able to do it, you know, through cross-moding. But actually, the comment was regarding the OpenSpot 4. I understand now, you know, I use the OpenSpot 3, and you can, you know, listen from the PC itself, whereas with the OpenSpot 4, I understand that's not possible.
I am not 100% sure, but I do know one of the models does that. I think it's It's whatever it is that has the built-in AMBI chip. So if you buy the Pro version or the one that can transcode, you can do the same thing on your PC.
Okay, yeah, right. I believe there are two versions of the four. That's true. Okay, well, thank you. Thank you very much, KD2WOT.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the features when they put in the three, the transcoder. Once you have the transcoder in your own hardware and not in the handy talkies, then you can do all kinds of cute little tricks with it. The same way that I have an AMBI chip that's basically a USB device. I plug the USB device into my computer and I can run any digital stream I want through the computer input and output a simulated voice. So that's why it has that feature. But you have to pay the higher price for the transcoding version of the OpenSpot 4. But, you know, I mean, I don't want to have this read as an advertisement for that because they're not giving me anything. But, you know, there are companies that just kind of let you sue, and there are other companies that will help you out if you need it. And I've mentioned this before. I pop the top shell of my OpenSpot behind a very heavy desk, and I was rather lazy. And I emailed them, and I asked them if I could acquire a replacement plastic shell. And they didn't ask anything, and they didn't ask for proof of anything. They didn't ask for any money. They just emailed me that they were mailing it to me. So they were very nice. I think they're located in Estonia. Anyway, any other questions or points of comment?
K2SDP.
Yes, Chris.
Well, here's a real basic question for you, as I'm a ham at this point. I haven't even looked at digital modes or the... I hear this hot spot and see sale all the time. What the heck are they? What are they doing? And that's coming from a retired IT guy. Probably embarrassing, but go ahead. Give me the helicopter view.
Okay, hotspots are a very interesting thing and probably not the best name to choose because hotspots are kind of a term that's more generic than we amateur radios use it for. Hotspots, as I'm sure you knew, were sometimes used when they changed from one generation to another generation of cell phones. The range would contract and the density of the cell towers wouldn't be enough, and so they would let you either buy or give you, under some circumstances, a cell tower hotspot that would let you leapfrog from your cell phone to the hotspot to the cell tower by boosting the signal. So it's sort of in line with that. In this case, though, the hotspot acts as an intermediary between your digital radio and the digital backbone, all these talk groups and wires, rooms, and D-star reflectors. So it acts as a kind of local repeater with access to the Internet. So you talk on your handy talkie or your mobile radio or your base station in digital mode. It gets picked up by a PiStar with an RF top hat. It gets decoded into a digital stream. It connects to your internet service provider and sends it to whatever network you want and whatever gateway room reflector is available. And it's like being hooked up to the worldwide digital network. So you don't get the locality of local digital repeaters. You can go on the local sign slot of the club, the DMR, and talk to the guys. Or you can go to the other time slot and talk to English worldwide, talk group 91. So it's repeaters, hotspots allow you to do that.
Gotcha, thank you, I appreciate it. And that's pretty much what I envisioned, but I wasn't sure, which is why, thanks, K2SDP.
Yeah, I think it has revolutionized digital radio, digital repeaters. In the old day, digital